2. Belly deep in a clutch of sweet fern, a fox watched Essie unpack her cart. He did not think of her as Essie, of course, did not have a name for her at all. She was just another human. The fox had, in any case, been observing her for a long while, moons and suns, and recognized clearly her ramshackle lean-to of plastic sheeting and canvas draping for the foxhole that it was. The fox also understood that the 4 chunks of green glass that she organized in a semicircle and referred to as the girls held great meaning to her. At times when Essie was not present, the fox had smelled them, no life there, and sifted through her possessions, which were negligible, except for a few discarded cans of soup that he had licked clean. He believed that she represented no threat, but he was an old fox, and one did not become an old fox by proceeding too confidently on any matter. One became an old fox by being careful and opportunistic, by mating as frequently as possible while avoiding entanglements, by never crossing roads in daylight, and by digging deeply in good, soft loam. This morning, his prudence appeared to be unnecessary. Essie's behavior was entirely in character. After she removed the bags and sundry mysterious items from her cart, she informed the glass fragments that Mother needed a snooze. "No tomfoolery, you girls," Essie said, and entered the lean-to to lie on the pile of movers' quilts she used as a mattress. Though the lean-to covered her body, her head poked out into the light. While Essie was settling into her sleep, the fox silently bared his teeth at the male mannequin top that she had set in the leaves beside the lean-to, but the mannequin did nothing. It was probably dead like the green glass. The fox chewed his paw and waited. Soon the old woman's breath settled into a sleeping rhythm, each deep intake followed by a shallow whistle of exhalation. The fox stretched slowly up from the bed of sweet fern and slunk a few steps toward the lean-to, wanting to be absolutely sure about the mannequin's intent or lack thereof. He bared his teeth more widely. The mannequin did not move. Yes, definitely dead. He trotted to within a few lengths of the lean-to and stopped. A whitish fluttering was appearing over the sleeping woman's head, white strands like cobwebs lifting from her cheeks, unfurling breezily and settling on her skin, coating it. New strands spun out from the laid strands, and they quickly covered her face, forming a mask that would soon extend all the way around her head. Moths circled in the dimness of the lean-to. The fox retreated a few steps, sniffing. He didn't like the white stuff. The white stuff was definitely alive, and it was definitely a different creature altogether from those he was familiar with. Even at a distance, the scent of the white stuff was strong and disturbingly mingled. There was blood and tissue in the scent, and intelligence and hunger, and an element of the deep, deep earth of the foxhole of foxholes. And what slept in that great bed? Not a fox, he was certain. His sniffs became whines, and he turned and began to trot away west. A sound of movement, someone else coming, carried through the woods behind him, and the fox's trot became a run. 3. After helping Oscar Silver inter Coco the cat, wrapped in a threadbare terry cloth bath towel, Frank drove the 2 short blocks to the house at 51 Smith Lane that he paid the mortgage on, but where, since he and Elaine had separated, only she and their 11-year-old daughter still resided. Elaine had been a social worker until 2 state budgets ago, but now she worked part-time at the Goodwill and volunteered at a couple of food pantries and at the Planned Parenthood in Maylock. The upside of this was that they didn't have to find money for childcare. When the school day ended, no one minded if Nana hung around at the Goodwill with her mother. The downside was that they were going to lose the house. This bothered Frank more than Elaine. In fact, it didn't seem to bother her at all. Despite her denials, he suspected that she planned to use the sale as an excuse to depart the area altogether, maybe take off for Pennsylvania where her sister lived. If that happened, Frank's every other weekend would become a weekend every other month at best. Except for visiting days, he made a concerted effort to avoid the place. Even then, if he could arrange for Elaine to bring Nana to him, that was his preference. The memories that went with the house, the sense of unfairness and failure, the patched hole in the kitchen wall, were too raw. Frank felt as though he had been tricked out of his entire life, and the best part of that life had been lived at 51 Smith Lane, the neat, plain ranch house with the duck on the mailbox painted by his daughter. The matter of the green Mercedes, however, made a stop-in imperative. As he jerked over to the curb, he spied Nana drawing with chalk in the driveway. It was an activity you'd normally associate with a much younger child, but his daughter had a talent for illustration. The previous school year, she had won second prize in a bookmark designing contest held by the local library. Nana's had shown a bunch of books flying like birds across a cloud bank. Frank had framed it and hung it in his office. He looked at it all the time. It was a beautiful thing, imagining books flying around inside his little girl's head. She sat cross-legged in the sunshine, butt planted in an inner tube, and her rainbow of implements arrayed around her in a fan. Along with her drawing ability, or maybe in accordance with it, Nana had a gift for making herself comfortable. She was a slow-moving, dreamy child, taking more after Frank than her vibrant mother, who never messed around about anything, was always straight to the point. He leaned over, popped the door of his truck. "Hey, Bright Eyes, come here." She squinted up at him.
"Daddy?"
"Last I heard," he said, working hard to keep the corners of his mouth turned up. "Come here, okay?"
"Right now?"
She had already glanced down to her picture. "Yes, right now." Frank took a deep breath. He hadn't started to get what Elaine called that way until he was leaving the judge, by which Elle meant losing his temper, which he rarely did, no matter what she thought. And today? At first he had been fine. Then, about 5 steps across Oscar Silver's grass, it was as if he had tripped some invisible trigger. Sometimes that just happened. Like when Elaine had kept after him about yelling at the PTA meeting, and he'd punched that hole in the wall, and Nana had run upstairs, crying, not understanding that sometimes you punched a thing so you wouldn't punch a person. Or that business with Fritz Mischaum, where he'd been a little out of control, granted, but Mischaum deserved it. Anyone who would do a thing like that to an animal deserved it. "That cat could have been my kid," was what he had been thinking as he crossed the grass. And then, boom, like time was a shoelace, and the length of it, between him walking and getting into the truck, had been knotted off. Because suddenly he was in his truck, he was driving for the house on Smith, and he couldn't recall getting in the truck at all. His hands were sweaty on the wheel and his cheeks hot, and he was still thinking about how the cat could have been his kid, except it wasn't a thought, more like an urgent flashing message on an LED screen. "Error, error, error. My kid, my kid, my kid." Nana carefully placed a stub of purple chalk in the empty spot between an orange and a green. She pushed up from her inner tube and stood for a couple of seconds, dusting off the rear end of her flowered yellow shorts and rubbing her chalky fingertips contemplatively. "Honey," said Frank, fighting not to scream. Because look, she had been right there, in the driveway, where some drunk asshole in a fancy car could drive right over her. "My kid, my kid, my kid." Nana took a step, stopped, steadied her fingers again, apparently with dissatisfaction. "Nana!" Frank, still twisted into a lean across the console. He slapped the passenger seat, slapped it hard. "Get over here!" The girl's head yanked up, her expression startled as if she had just been awakened from sleep by a thunderclap. She shuffled forward, and when she reached the open door, Frank grabbed the front of her t-shirt and tugged her up close.
"Hey, you're stretching my shirt," Nana said.
"Never mind that," Frank said. "Your shirt's not the big deal here. I'll tell you what the big deal is, so listen to me. Who drives the green Mercedes? Which house does it go with?"
"What?"
Nana pressed at his grip on the front of her shirt.
"What are you talking about? You're gonna ruin my shirt."
"Didn't you hear me? Forget the fucking shirt!" The words were out, and he hated them, but he was also satisfied to see her eyes jump from her shirt to him. He finally had her attention. Nana blinked and inhaled. "Okay, now that your head's out of the clouds, let's get together on this.
You told me about some guy on your paper route who drove a green Mercedes. What's his name? Which house does he live in?
Can't remember his name. I'm sorry, Daddy.
Nana bit her lower lip.
It's the house beside the one with the big flag, though. It's got a wall on Briar, top of the hill.
Okay. Frank let go of the shirt. Nana didn't move.
Are you done being mad?
Honey, I wasn't mad. And when she said nothing. Okay, I was. A little. But not at you. She wouldn't look at him. Just kept rubbing her goddamn fingers together. He loved her. She was the most important thing in his life. But sometimes it was hard to believe she had all four wheels on the road. Thank you. Some of the heat was draining from his face, some of the sweat cooling on his skin. Thank you, Bright Eyes.
Sure,
said Nana. The girl retreated a small step, the sound of her sneaker sole against the pavement impossibly loud in Frank's ear. Frank straightened up in his seat. One more thing. Do me a favor and stay out of the driveway. For the rest of the morning, anyway, till I can sort something out. There's a man driving around crazy. Draw inside with your paper, all right? She was biting at her lower lip.
All right, Daddy.
You're not gonna cry, are you?
No, Daddy.
All right, that's my girl. I'll see you next weekend, okay? He realized his lips were incredibly dry. He asked himself what else he was supposed to have done, and a voice inside him replied, Well, gee, what else could you have done? Maybe you could have, I don't know, this will probably sound totally wild, Frank, but hey, maybe you could have not freaked the fuck out. The voice was like an amused version of Frank's own voice. The voice of a man who was kicked back in a lawn chair and wearing sunglasses and maybe sipping on an iced tea.
Okay.
The nod she gave him was robotic. Behind her, on the pavement, she had drawn an elaborate tree, its canopy spreading up one side of the driveway, its gnarled trunk cutting across. Moss hung from the branches and flowers bearded the base. Roots trailed down to the outline of an underground lake. I like what you got there, he said and smiled.
Thank you, Daddy, Nana said.
I just don't want you to get hurt. The smile on his face felt like it was nailed on. His daughter sniffed and gave him another robotic nod. He knew she was sucking back tears. Hey, Nana, he started, but the words he wanted dispersed as the interior voice piped up again, telling him she'd had enough, to just leave it the hell alone.
Bye, Daddy.
She reached out and pushed his truck door gently shut, spun and jogged up the driveway, scattering her chalks, striding across her tree, smudging the greens and blacks of the treetop, head down, shoulders shaking. Kids, he told himself, can't always appreciate when you're trying to do the right thing. 4. There were 3 overnight filings on Clint's desk. The first was predictable, but concerning. One of the officers on staff the previous night speculated that Angel Fitzroy seemed to be ramping up to something. At Lights Out, Angel had attempted to engage the officer over an issue of semantics. The authorities at dueling were all strictly to be referred to as officer. Synonyms such as guard or screw, let alone, obviously, slurs like asshole or motherfucker, were unacceptable. Angel had asked Officer Wettermore if he understood English. Of course they were guards, Angel said. They could be officers too, that was fine, but they couldn't not be guards because they guarded. Weren't they guarding the prisoners? If you baked a cake, weren't you a baker? If you dug a hole, weren't you a digger? Warned the inmate that she had arrived at the end of reasonable discussion and could expect consequences if she didn't lock it down immediately, Wettermore wrote. Inmate relented and entered her cell, but further asked, How could we expect prisoners to follow the rules when the words of the rules did not make any sense? Inmate's tone was threatening. Angel Fitzroy was one of the few women in the prison who Clint regarded as genuinely dangerous. Based on his interactions with her, he believed she might be a sociopath. He had never glimpsed any empathy in her, and her record inside was fat with infractions,
drugs, fighting, threatening behavior.
How do you suppose you'd have felt if the man you attacked had died from his injuries, Angel? He had asked her during a group session.
Ah, Angel had said, sunken down in the chair, her eyes roaming his office walls.
I'd have felt, pretty bad, I guess.
Then she'd smacked her lips, gaze fastening on the Hockney print.
Look at that picture, girls. Wouldn't you like to visit where it is?
While her assault conviction was bad enough, a man in a truck stop had said something to Angel that she hadn't liked, and she'd broken his nose with a bottle of ketchup, there were indications that she'd gotten away with much worse. A detective from Charleston had driven to Dueling to solicit Clint's help with a case relating to Fitzroy. What the detective wanted was information concerning the death of a former landlord of Angel's. This had happened a couple of years before her current incarceration. Angel had been the only suspect, but there was nothing except vicinity to tie her to the crime and no apparent motive. The thing was, as Clint himself knew, Angel had a history of not needing much of a motive. 20 cents off in her change could be enough to blow her up. The Charleston detective had been nearly gleeful in his description of the landlord's corpse.
Looked like the old boy just fell down the stairs, got his neck broke. But the coroner said someone had been to work on his package, pre-mortem. Balls was, I forget how the coroner put it exactly, if he said fractured or whatever, but layman's terms, he said, they were basically squished.
Clint wasn't in the business of flipping on his patients, and told the detective so, but he had mentioned the inquiry to Angel later. With an expression of glassy wonderment, she responded,
Balls can fracture?
Now he made a note to himself to drop in on Angel that day, take a seismology reading. The second filing was about an inmate on janitorial duty who claimed that there was an infestation of moths in the prison kitchen. A check by Officer Murphy found no moths. Inmate willingly submitted to a urine drop, clean for drugs and alcohol. That one seemed to translate as a case of an inmate working hard to drive an officer crazy and an officer working hard to return the favor. Clint had no interest in continuing the circle by following up. He filed it. Kitty McDavid was the last incident. Officer Wettermore had jotted some of her ranting. The black angel came up from the roots and down from the branches. Her fingers are death, and her hair is full of cobwebs, and dream is her kingdom. After the administration of a dose of Haldol, she had been moved to A-Wing. Clint left his office and passed through admin toward the east section of the prison, which contained the cell wings. The prison was shaped roughly like a lowercase T, with the long central line of the corridor known as Broadway, parallel to Route 17, West Lavin Road outside. The administration offices, the communications center, the officers' room, the staff lounge, and the classrooms were all situated at the west end of Broadway. The other corridor, Main Street, ran perpendicular to West Lavin. Main Street went from the prison's front door straight ahead to the craft shop, the utility room, the laundry, and the gymnasium. On the other side of Main Street, Broadway continued eastward, passing the library, the mess hall, the visitor's room, the infirmary, and intake, before arriving at the three cell wings. A security door separated the cells from Broadway. Clint stopped here and pressed the button that notified the booth that he wanted to enter. A buzzer sounded, and the bolts of the security door retracted with a clunk. Clint pushed through. These wings, A, B, and C, were arranged in a pincer shape. In the center of the pincer was the booth, a shed-like structure armored in bulletproof glass. It contained the officers' monitors and communication board. Although most of the prison population mixed in the yard and elsewhere, the wings were organized according to the theoretical danger presented by each inmate. There were 64 cells in the prison, 12 in A wing, 12 in C wing, and 40 in B wing. A and C were set entirely on ground level. B wing was stacked with a second level of cells. A-Wing was medical, although some inmates considered tranquil were also housed there, at the far end of the corridor. Inmates not necessarily tranquil but settled, such as Kitty McDavid, were housed in B-Wing. C-Wing was for the troublemakers. C was the least populous residence, with half of the 12 cells currently empty. When there was a breakdown or a severe disciplinary issue, it was official procedure to remove the inmate from her cell and place her in one of the I cells in C-Wing.
Inmates called these the jerk-off cells, because ceiling cameras allowed the officers to observe what the inmate was doing at all times. The implication was that male officers got their jollies by spying on them. The cameras were essential, though. If an inmate might attempt to harm or even kill herself, you needed to be able to see it to prevent it. The officer in the booth today was Captain Vanessa Lampley. She leaned over from the board to open the door for him. Clint sat beside her and asked if she could bring up Unit 12 on the monitor so he could check on McDavid.
"Let's go to the videotape," he yelled cheerily.
Lampley gave him a look.
"Let's go to the videotape.
You know, it's what Werner Wolf always says." She shrugged and opened Unit 12 for visual inspection.
"The sportscaster?"
Clint said.
Vanessa shrugged again. "Sorry, must be before my time."
Clint thought that was bizarre. Werner Wolf was a legend, but he dropped it so he could study the screen. Kitty was in a fetal position, face twisted down into her arms.
"Seen anything out of line?"
Lampley shook her head. She'd come in at 7 and McDavid had been snoozing the entire time. That didn't surprise Clint. Heyerdahl was powerful stuff. He was worried about Kitty, though, a mother of two who had been convicted of forging prescriptions. In an ideal world, Kitty would never have been put in a correctional facility in the first place. She was a bipolar drug addict with a junior high school education. The surprise was how her bipolarity had manifested on this occasion. In the past, she had withdrawn. Last night's outburst of violent raving was unprecedented in her history. Clint had been fairly confident that the course of lithium he had prescribed for her was working. For over half a year, Kitty had been level-headed, generally upbeat, no sizable peaks or valleys, and she'd made the decision to testify for the prosecution in the Griner brothers' case, which was not only courageous, but had a strong potential for advancing her own cause. There was every reason to believe that she could be paroled soon after the trial. The two of them had started to discuss the halfway house environment, what Kitty would do the first time that she became aware that someone was holding, how she would reintroduce herself to her children. Had it all started to look too rosy for her? Lampley must have read his concern.
"She'll be all right, Doc. It was a one-off, that's what I think. The full moon, probably. Everything else is screwy, you know."
The stocky veteran was pragmatic but conscientious, exactly what you wanted in a head officer. It also didn't hurt that Van Lampley was a competitive arm wrestler of some renown. Her biceps swelled the gray sleeves of her uniform.
"Oh, yeah," Clint said, remembering the highway smash-up that Lila had mentioned.
A couple of times he had attended Van's birthday party. She lived on the back of the mountain. "You must have had to come to work the long way. Lila told me about the truck that crashed. Had to bulldoze the whole heap," she said.
"Huh," Van said. "I didn't see any of that. Must have got it cleaned up before I left. I meant West and Rickman."
Jody West and Claire Rickman were the regular day PAs. Like Clint, they were 9-to-5ers.
"They never showed, so we got no one on medical. Coates is pissed, says she's gonna..."
"You didn't see anything on Mountain?" Hadn't Lila said that it was Mountain Rest Road? Clint was sure, almost sure, anyhow, she had. Van shook her head.
"Wouldn't be the first time, though."
She grinned, displaying a big set of yellowing choppers.
"There was a truck that flipped on that road last fall. What a disaster. It was from PetSmart, you know? Cat litter and dog food all over the road."
5. The trailer belonging to the late Truman Mayweather had not looked good the last time Terry Coombs was out here, to cool down a domestic disturbance involving one of Truman's many sisters who had vacated the residence shortly thereafter. But this morning it looked like high tea in hell. Mayweather was sprawled beneath the eating table with some of his brains on his bare chest. The furniture, mostly purchased at roadside rummage sales, dollar discount, or Chapter 11, Terry guessed, was scattered everywhere. The television was upside down in the rust-scaled shower stall. In the sink, a toaster was making friends with a Converse sneaker mended with friction tape. Blood was splashed all over the walls. Plus, of course, there was a hunched-over body with his head sticking out through the side of the trailer and his plumber's crack showing above his beltless jeans. A wallet on the floor of the trailer contained an ID for Mr. Jacob Pyle of Little Rock, Arkansas. How much strength did it take to pound a man's head through a wall like that? Terry wondered. The trailer walls were thin, granted, but still. He duly photographed everything, then did a 360 panning shot with one of the department's iPads. He stood just inside the door long enough to send the photographic evidence to Lenny Mars at the station. She would print off a set of pics for Lila and start two files, one digital and one hard copy. To Lila, Terry texted a brief message. "Know you're tired, but you better get out here." Faint but approaching came the recognizable sound of St. Teresa's one and only fully equipped ambulance. Not a full-throated whoop, 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 but a somehow prissy wink, wink, wink. Roger Elway was stringing yellow crime scene do not cross tape with a cigarette hanging from the corner of his mouth. Terry called to him from the trailer's steps. "If Lila finds out you've been smoking at a crime scene, she'll tear you a new one." Roger removed the cigarette from his mouth, examined it as if he'd never seen such a thing before, put it out on the sole of his shoe, and tucked the butt into his shirt pocket. "Where is Lila, anyway? Assistant DA's on his way. He'll expect her." The ambo pulled up, the doors sprang open, and Dick Bartlett and Andy Emerson, two EMTs that Terry had worked with before, got out fast, already gloving up. One carried a backboard, the other toted the portable hospital they called First in Bag. Terry grunted. "Only the assistant duck's ass, huh? Two dead, and we still don't rate the top guy." Roger shrugged. Bartlett and Emerson, meanwhile, after the initial hustle, had come to a halt beside the trailer, where the head stuck out of the wall. Emerson said, "I don't think that gentleman is going to benefit too much from our services." Bartlett was pointing a rubber-gloved finger at the place where the neck protruded. "I believe he's got Mr. Hanky tattooed on his neck." "The talking turd from South Park? Seriously?" Emerson came around to look. "Oh, yeah, so he does."
"Howdy ho!"
Bartlett sang. "Hey," Terry said. "That's great, guys. Someday you should put your routine on YouTube. Right now, we got another corpse inside, and there's a woman in our cruiser who could use a little help." Roger said, "You sure you want to wake her up?" He jerked his head at Unit 4. A swatch of lank, dirty hair was plastered against the rear window. "Girlfriend be crashing. Christ knows what she's been on." Bartlett and Emerson came across the junked-out yard to the cruiser, and Bartlett knocked on the window. "Ma'am? Miss?" Nothing. He knocked harder. "Come on, wakey-wakey." Still nothing. He tried the door handle and looked back at Terry and Roger when it didn't give. "I need you to unlock it." "Oh," Roger said. "Right." He thumbed the unlock button on his key fob. Dick Bartlett opened the back door, and Tiffany Jones spilled out like a load of dirty laundry. Bartlett grabbed her just in time to keep the top half of her body from hitting the weedy gravel. Emerson sprang forward to help. Roger stayed put, looking vaguely irked. "If she 86'd on us, Lila's gonna be pissed like a bear. She's the only wit." "Where's her face?" Emerson asked. His voice was shocked. "Where's her goddamn face?" That got Terry moving. He moved next to the cruiser as the two EMTs eased Tiffany gently to the ground. Terry grabbed her hanging hair, why, he wasn't sure, but let go in a hurry when something greasy squelched between his fingers. He wiped his hand on his shirt. Her hair was shot through with white, membranous stuff. Her face was also covered, her features now just dimly visible, as if seen through the kind of veil some older ladies still wore on their hats when they went to church out here in Thank You Jesus country. "What is that stuff?" Terry was still rubbing his hand. The stuff felt nasty, slippery, a little tingly. "Spider webs?" Roger was looking over his shoulder, eyes wide with a mixture of fascination and revulsion. "It's coming out of her nose, Ter. And her eyes. What the fuck?" EMT Bartlett pulled a swatch of the goo away from Tiffany's jawline and wiped it on his own shirt. But before he did, Terry saw that it appeared to be melting as soon as it was off her face. He looked at his own hand. The skin was dry and clear. Nothing on his shirt either, although there had been a moment ago. Emerson had his fingers on the side of Tiffany's throat. "I have a pulse, nice and steady, and she's breathing fine. I can see that crap billowing out and then sucking in. Let's get the Mabus." Bartlett hauled the orange Mabus all-in-one kit out of the first-in bag, hesitated, then went back into the bag for disposable glove packs. He gave one set to Emerson and took another for himself. Terry watched, wishing mightily he hadn't touched the webby stuff on Tiffany's skin. What if it was poisonous? They got a blood pressure that Emerson said was normal. The EMTs went back and forth about whether or not to clear her eyes and check her pupils, and, although they didn't know it then, made the best decision of their lives when they decided not to. While they talked, Terry saw something he didn't like. Tiffany's web-encrusted mouth slowly opening and closing, as if she were chewing on air. Her tongue had gone white. Filaments rose from it, wavering like plankton. Bartlett rose.
We should get her to St. Teresa's stat, unless you have a problem with that. Say so if you do, because she seems stable.
He looked at Emerson, who nodded.
Look at her eyes, Roger said. All white. Gag me with a spoon.
Go on, take her, Terry said. It's not like we can question her.
The two decedents, Bartlett said. Is this stuff growing on them?
No, Terry said, and pointed to the protruding head. On that one you can see for yourselves. Not Truman, the guy inside, either.
Any in the sink? Bartlett asked. The toilet, the shower, I'm talking about wet places.
The TV is in the shower stall, Terry said, which wasn't an answer, was in fact a total non sequitur, but all he could think of to say at first. Another non sequitur. Was the squeak open yet? It was early, but you were allowed a beer or two on mornings like this. There was a special dispensation for gruesome corpses and creepy shit on people's faces. He kept looking at Tiffany Jones, who was slowly but steadily being buried alive under a diaphanous white fog of something. He forced himself to speak to the question. Just on her. Roger Elway now said what they were all thinking. Fellas, what if it's contagious? No one replied.
Terry caught movement in the corner of his eye and swung back to look at the trailer. At first he thought the flock lifting off from its roof was butterflies, but butterflies were colorful, and these were plain brown and gray. Not butterflies, but moths. Hundreds of them.
6. A dozen years before, on a muggy day in later summer, a call came in to animal control about a raccoon under the floor of the converted barn that the local Episcopalian church used as a pastoral center. The concern was possible rabies. Frank had driven right over. He put on his face mask and elbow-length gloves, crawled under the barn, shone a flashlight on the animal, and it had darted, just the way a healthy raccoon should. That would have been that. Rabid raccoons were serious, trespassing raccoons not so much. Except that the pretty 20-something woman who had shown him the hole under the barn had offered him a glass of blue Kool-Aid from the bake sale going on in the parking lot. It had been pretty nasty, watered down, not enough sugar. But Frank drank $3 worth in order to stay there in the yellowing churchyard grass, talking to the woman, who had a wonderful big laugh and a way of standing with her hands on her hips that made him feel tingly.
"Well, are you going to do your duty, Mr. Geary?"
Elaine finally asked in her patented way, abruptly chopping the head off the small talk and getting to the point.
"I'd be happy to let you take me out if you put a lid on that critter that keeps killing things under the church floor. That's my offer."
Your lips have turned blue. He had come back after work and nailed a piece of scrap over the hole under the barn. Sorry, raccoon, a man's got to do what a man's got to do. And then he had taken his future wife to the movies. 12 years ago. So what had happened? Was it him, or did marriage simply have a shelf life? For a long time, Frank had thought they were doing all right. They had the kid, the house, their health. Not everything was hunky-dunky, of course. Money was touch and go. Nana wasn't the most engaged student. Sometimes Frank got, well, things wore him down, and when he was worn down, a certain edge emerged. But everyone had failings. And over the course of 12 years, you were bound to spring an occasional leak. Only his wife didn't see it that way. 8 months ago, she'd told him exactly how she saw it. She had shared her insight after the famous kitchen wall punch. Shortly before the famous kitchen wall punch, she'd told him she'd given $800 to her church, part of a fund drive to feed starving kids in some abysmally fucked up part of Africa.
Frank wasn't heartless. He grasped the suffering. But you didn't give away money you couldn't afford to give away. You didn't risk your own child's situation to help someone else's kids. Crazy as that had been, an entire mortgage payment zooming its way across the ocean, it hadn't prompted the famous wall punch. That was prompted by what she had said next, and the look on Elaine's face when she'd said it, simultaneously insolent and closed off. It was my decision because it was my money. As if her marriage vows meant nothing to her 11 years on. As if she could do anything she wanted without putting him in the loop. So he had punched the wall, not her, the wall, and Nana had run upstairs wailing, and Elaine had made her declaration. You're going to snap on us, baby. One of these days, it won't be the wall. Nothing Frank said or did could change her mind. It was either a trial separation or a divorce, and Frank chose the former. And her prediction had been wrong. He hadn't snapped, never would. He was strong. He was a protector. Which left a fairly important question. What was she trying to prove? What benefit was she getting by putting him through this? Was it some unresolved childhood issue? Was it plain old sadism? Whatever it was fucking unreal. And fucking senseless. You did not, as an African-American man in the Tri-Counties, or any county in the United States, arrive at the age of 38 without encountering far more than your fair share of senselessness. Racism was the epitome of senselessness, after all. He recalled a miner's kid back in first or second grade, her front teeth fanned out like a poker hand, her hair in pigtails so short they looked like finger stubs. She had pressed a finger against his wrist and observed,
"You are the color of rotten, Frank, like under my papa's nails has."
The girl's expression had been half amused, half impressed, and cataclysmically dumb. Even as a child, Frank had recognized that black hole of incurable stupid. It amazed him and left him flabbergasted. Later, when he saw it in other faces, it would come to scare him and anger him. But he was awestruck then. Stupid like that had its own gravitational field. It pulled at you. Only Elaine wasn't dumb. You couldn't get farther from dumb than Elaine. Elaine knew what it was like to be followed around a department store by some white kid who didn't even have a GED, playing like he's Batman and is going to catch her shoplifting a jar of peanuts. Elaine had been cursed by protesters outside Planned Parenthood, consigned to hell by people who didn't even know her name. So what did she want? Why inflict this pain on him? One nagging possibility. She was right to be worried. As he went after the green Mercedes, Frank kept seeing Nana moving away from him, kicking her neatly arranged pieces of chalk and tracking through her drawing. Frank knew he wasn't perfect, but he also knew that he was basically good. He helped people. He helped animals. He loved his daughter, and he would do anything to protect her, and he had never put an abusive hand on his wife. Had he made mistakes? Was the famous wall punch one of them? Frank admitted as much. He would have stated it in a court of law. But he had never hurt anyone who didn't deserve to be hurt, and he was just going to talk to the Mercedes guy, right? Frank pulled his truck through a fancy wrought iron gate and parked behind the green Mercedes. The front fender on the left side was road dusty, but the right side was sparkling clean. You could see where the son of a bitch had taken a rag to it. Frank walked up the slate path connecting the driveway to the door of the big white house. Garden berms planted with sassafras lined the path, and the canopies created a corridor. Birds twittered in the branches above him. At the end of the path, by the foot of the steps, was a young lilac tree in a stone planter near full bloom. Frank resisted the urge to uproot it. He climbed to the porch. On the face of the solid oak door was a brass knocker in the shape of a caduceus. He told himself to turn around and drive straight home. Then he grabbed the knocker and banged it over and over against the plate. 7. It took a while for Garth Flickinger to extricate himself from the couch.
"Hold on, hold on," he said, pointlessly.
The door was too thick and his voice too raspy.
He had been smoking dope nonstop since he returned home from his visit to Truman Mayweather's stately pleasure trailer. If anyone had asked him about the drugs, Garth would have made it a point to impress upon the questioner that he was merely an occasional recreational user, but this morning had been an exception. An emergency, in fact. It wasn't every day that you were taking a whiz in your drug dealer's trailer and World War III broke out on the other side of the flimsy shithouse door. Something had happened. Crashing, shooting, screaming, and in a moment of incomprehensible idiocy, Garth had actually opened the door to check out what was going on. What he saw would be hard to forget, perhaps impossible. At the far end of the trailer was a black-haired woman, naked from the waist down. She had hoisted up Truman's Arkansas buddy by his hair and the belt of his jeans and was pounding him face first into the wall. Womp, womp, womp. Picture a siege engine slamming a massive tree against castle gates. The man's head was awash in blood and his arms were ragdoll flopping around at his sides. Meanwhile, there was Truman slumped on the floor with a bullet hole in his forehead. And the strange woman? Her expression was horrifyingly placid. It was as if she were just going about her business with no particular concern, except that her business was using a man's head as a battering ram. Garth had gently closed the door, hopped on the toilet lid, and climbed out the window. He had then sprinted for his car and driven home at the speed of light. The experience had shaken his nerves a bit, and that was not a common occurrence. Garth Flickinger, board-certified plastic surgeon, member in good standing of the American Society of Plastic Surgeons, was usually a pretty steady-handed fellow. He was feeling better now. The rock that he'd smoked had helped with that, but the banging on the door was unwelcome. Garth navigated his way around the couch and through the living room, crunching through a small sea of fast food boxes on the way. On the flat screen, an extremely sexy reporter was being extremely serious about a bunch of comatose old ladies at a nursing home in D.C. Her seriousness only enhanced her sexiness. She was an A cup, Garth thought, but her frame begged for a B. Why only women? The reporter on the flat screen wondered aloud. At first we thought just the very elderly and the very young were vulnerable, but now it appears that women across age groups. Garth rested his forehead against the door and slapped it. Stop! Quit it! Open up! The voice was deep and pissed off. He tapped some reserve strength and lifted his head to peer through the spy hole. An African-American man stood outside, mid-30s, broad shoulders, face with terrific bone structure. The man's beige uniform momentarily caused Garth's pulse to accelerate, cop, but then he noticed the patch read animal control. Ah, you are a dog catcher. A handsome dog of a dog catcher, to be sure, but a dog catcher nonetheless. No fugitive canines here, sir, so no problem. Or was there? Hard to be completely sure. Could this fellow be a friend of the half-naked harpy from the trailer? Better to be her friend than her enemy, Garth supposed, but far, far better to avoid her altogether. Did she send you? Garth asked. I didn't see anything. Tell her that, okay? I don't know what you're talking about. I came here on my own. Now open up! The man yelled again. Why? Garth asked, adding, no way, for good measure. Sir, I just want to talk to you. The dog catcher had made an effort to lower his voice, but Garth could see him twisting his mouth around, fighting the need, yes, a need, to continue yelling. Not right now, Garth said. Someone ran over a cat. The person was driving a green Mercedes. You have a green Mercedes.
That's unfortunate.
Meaning the cat, not the Mercedes. Garth liked cats. He had liked his Flamin' Groovies t-shirt as well, which was balled up on the floor by the stairs. Garth had used it to clean some blood off the fender of his car. Tough times all around.
But I don't know anything about that, and I'm having a difficult morning, and so you'll have to leave. Sorry.
A thud, and the door shook in its frame. Garth backed up. The guy had kicked it. Through the spy hole, Garth could see that the cords on the dog catcher's neck were taut.
My kid lives down the hill, you dumb fuck. What if that had been her? What if you drove over my kid instead of that cat?
I'm calling the cops, Garth said.
He hoped he sounded more convincing to the guy than he did to himself. He retreated to the living room, sank into the couch, and picked up his pipe. The bag of dope was on the coffee table. Glass began to shatter outside. There was a metallic crunch.
Was Signor Dogcatcher molesting his Mercedes?
Garth didn't care. Not today. It was insured, anyway. That poor junkie girl. Tiffany was her name, and she was so ruined and so sweet. Was she dead? Had the people who'd attacked the trailer, he assumed the strange woman was part of a gang, killed her? He told himself that Tiff, sweet as she was, wasn't his problem. Better not to fixate on what couldn't be changed. The bag was blue plastic, so the rocks appeared blue until you removed them. This was probably True Mayweather's half-assed tribute to Breaking Bad. There would be no more tributes from Truman Mayweather, half-assed or otherwise, not after this morning. Garth picked a rock, dropped it in the cup of his pipe.
Whatever Signor Dogcatcher was doing to the Mercedes now caused the car alarm to go off. Beep, beep, beep.
The television showed footage of a bright hospital room. Two female shapes lay under hospital sheets. Wispy cocoons covered the women's heads. It looked like they wore beehives that started at their chins. Garth fired up, sucked down a lungful, held it.
Beep, beep, beep.
Garth had a daughter, Kathy. She was 8, hydrocephalic. Lived in a facility, a very nice one, the coast of North Carolina, close enough to catch salt on the breeze. He paid for it all, which he could do. It was better for the girl if her mother looked after the details. Poor Kathy. What had he told himself about the junkie girl? Oh, right. Better not to fixate on what couldn't be changed. Easier said than done. Poor Garth. Poor old ladies with their heads stuck in beehives. Poor cat. The beautiful reporter was standing on a sidewalk in front of a gathering crowd. Honestly, she was fine with the A cup. The B was just a thought. Had she had a nose job? Wow, if she had, and Garth wasn't quite certain he'd need to see up close, it was a superb one. Really natural, with a pretty little button tip. The CDC has put out a bulletin, she announced. Do not, under any circumstances, attempt to remove the growth.
Call me crazy, Garth said, but that just makes me want to.
Tired of the news, tired of the animal control guy, tired of the car alarm, although he supposed he would shut it off once the animal control guy decided to take his bad temper somewhere else, tired of fixating on what couldn't be changed, Garth channel surfed until he found an infomercial about building yourself an abdominal six-pack in just 6 days. He attempted to take down the 800 number, but the only pen he could find didn't work on the skin of his palm. Chapter 4 1 The total population of McDowell, Bridger, and Dueling counties amounted to roughly 72,000 souls, 55% male, 45% female. This was down 5,000 from the last full U.S. census, officially making the tri-counties an out-migration area. There were two hospitals, one in McDowell County, great gift shop, read the only post in the comments section of the McDowell Hospital's website, and a much bigger one in Dueling County, where the largest population, 32,000, resided. There were a total of 10 walk-in clinics in the three counties, plus 24 so-called pain clinics out in the Piney Woods, where various opioid drugs could be obtained with prescriptions written on the spot. Once, before most of the mines had played out, the tri-counties had been known as the Republic of Fingerless Men. These days it had become the Republic of Unemployed Men, but there was a bright side. Most of those under 50 had all their fingers, and it had been 10 years since anyone had died in a mine cave-in. On the morning Evie Doe, so recorded by Lila Norcross because her prisoner would give no last name, visited Truman Mayweather's trailer, most of the 14,000 or so females in Doolin County awoke as usual and started their day. Many of them saw the television reports about the spreading contagion that was first called Australian sleeping sickness, then the female sleeping flu, and then the Aurora flu, named for the princess in the Walt Disney retelling of the Sleeping Beauty fairy tale. Few of the Tri-County women who saw the reports were frightened by them. Australia, Hawaii, and Los Angeles were faraway places, after all. And although Michaela Morgan's report from that old folks' home in Georgetown was mildly alarming, and Washington, D.C. was geographically close, not even a day's drive, D.C. was still a city. And for most people in the Tri-Counties, that put it in an entirely different category. Besides, not many people in the area watched News America, preferring Good Day Wheeling or Ellen DeGeneres. The first sign that something might be wrong, even out here in God's country, came shortly after 8 o'clock a.m. It arrived at the doors of St. Teresa's in the person of Yvette Quinn, who parked her elderly Jeep Cherokee askew at the curb and came charging into the ER with her infant twin girls crooked in her arms. A tiny, cocoon-swaddled face rested against each of her breasts. She was screaming like a fire siren, bringing doctors and nurses running.
"Someone help my babies! They won't wake up! They won't wake up for anything!"
Tiffany Jones, much older but similarly swaddled, arrived soon thereafter, and by 3 o'clock that afternoon, the ER was full. And still they came, fathers and mothers carrying daughters, girls carrying little sisters, uncles carrying nieces, husbands carrying wives. There was no Judge Judy, no Dr. Phil, and no game shows on the waiting room TV that afternoon. Only news. And all of it was about the mysterious sleeping sickness, the one that affected only those with the XX chromosome. The exact minute, half minute, or second when sleeping female Homo sapiens stopped waking up and began to form their coverings was never conclusively determined. Based on the cumulative data, however, scientists were eventually able to narrow the window to a point between 7:37 a.m. Eastern Standard Time and 7:57 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. "We can only wait for them to wake up," said George Alderson on News America. "And so far, at least, none of them have. Here's Michaela Morgan with more." 2. By the time Lila Norcross arrived at the square brick building that housed the Doolin County Sheriff's Office on one side and Municipal Affairs on the other, it was all hands on deck. Deputy Reed Barrows was waiting at the curb, ready to babysit Lila's current prisoner. "Be good, Evie," she said, opening the door. "I'll be right back." "Be good, Lila," Evie said. "I'll be right here." She laughed. Blood from her nose was drying to a cracked glaze on her cheeks. More blood from the gash on her forehead had stiffened her hair in front, forming a small peacock fan. As Lila exited the car, making way for Reed to slide in, Evie added, "Triple-double," and laughed some more. "Forensics is on the way to that trailer," Reed said. "Also the ADA in Unit 6. "Good," Lila said, and trotted toward the door of the station. "Triple-double," she thought. Ah, there it was. At least 10 points, 10 assists, and 10 rebounds. And that was what the girl had done last night at the basketball game. The one Lila had come to see. The girl, she thought of her. Her name was Sheila. It wasn't the girl's fault. Sheila's fault. Her name was the first step toward what? She didn't know. She just didn't know. And Clint. What did Clint want? She knew she shouldn't care, given the circumstances, but she did. He was a true mystery to her. A familiar image came. Her husband, sitting at the kitchen counter, staring out at the elms in the backyard, running his thumb over his knuckles, vaguely grimacing. Long ago, she'd stopped asking him if he was all right. "Just thinking," he always said, "just thinking." But about what? And about whom? These were obvious questions, weren't they? Lila couldn't believe how tired she felt, how weak, as if she had dribbled out of her uniform and all over her shoes in the 20 or so paces between the cruiser and the steps. It suddenly seemed as though everything was open to question. And if Clint wasn't Clint, then who was she? Who was anybody? She needed to focus. Two men were dead, and the woman who had probably killed them was in the back of Lila's cruiser, higher than a kite. Lila could be tired and weak, but not now. Oscar Silver and Barry Holden were standing in the main office. "Gentlemen," she said. "Chief," they said, almost in unison. Judge Silver was older than God and shaky on his pins, but suffered from no shortage in the brains department. Barry Holden eked out a living for himself and his tribe of female dependents, one wife, four daughters, writing wills and contracts, and negotiating insurance settlements, mostly with that notorious dragon Drew T. Barry of Drew T. Barry Indemnity. Holden was also one of the half a dozen Tri-County lawyers who served as public defenders on a rotating basis. He was a good guy, and it didn't take long for Lila to explain what she wanted. He was agreeable, but needed a retainer. He said a dollar would do. "Linny, do you have a dollar?" Lila asked her dispatcher. "It might look funny if I hired representation for a woman I've arrested on 2 counts of capital murder." Linny handed Barry a dollar. He put it in his pocket, turned to Judge Silver, and spoke in his best courtroom voice. "Having been retained by Lynette Mars on behalf of the prisoner Sheriff Norcross has just taken into custody, I request and petition that..." "What's her name, Lila?" "Evie, no last yet. Call her Evie Doe." "That Evie Doe be remanded to the custody of Dr. Clinton Norcross for a psychiatric examination, said examination to take place at Dueling Correctional Facility for Women." "So ordered," Judge Silver said smartly.
What about the district attorney?" Linny asked from her desk. "Doesn't Janker get a say?"
"Janker agrees in absentia," Judge Silver replied. "Having saved his incompetent bacon in my courtroom on more than one occasion, I can say that with complete confidence. I order Evie Doe to be transported to Dueling Correctional immediately and held there for a period of... how about 48 hours, Lila?"
"Make it 96, Barry Holden said, apparently feeling that he ought to do something for his client.
"I'm okay with 96, Judge," Lila said. "I just wanted to get someplace where she won't hurt herself anymore while I get some answers."
Linny spoke up. In Lila's opinion, she was becoming a bit of a pain.
"Will Clint and Warden Coates be okay with the guest camper?"
"I'll handle that," Lila said, and thought again about her new prisoner. Evie Doe, the mystery killer who knew Lila's name and who babbled about triple doubles. Obviously a coincidence, but an unwelcome and badly timed one. "Let's get her in here long enough to roll some fingerprints. Also, Linny and I need to take her into one of the holding cells and put her into some county browns. The shirt she's got on has to be marked as evidence, and it's all she's wearing. I can't very well take her up to the prison buck-ass naked, can I?"
"No, as her lawyer, I couldn't approve of that at all," Barry said.